What's the most exciting thing to come out of IBM Think this year? Kate Sewell is Director of Technical Product Management for Granite. Kate, welcome back. What's your pick for IBM Think?
My pick is the research keynotes. We talked about a new wave of computing. So we've got traditional classical computing, we've got quantum computing, and at Think we announced a new way of building with models, generative computing.
It's really exciting. Kautar El-Megrawi is a principal research scientist and manager for Hybrid Cloud Platform. Kautar, welcome back. What was your favorite?
My favorite was also the generative computing part, but also the launch of a lot of AI agents and at what's our Watson Orchestrate platform, over 150 enterprise-ready AI agent. That's really huge.
Yeah, that is huge, and we will talk about that. And finally, last but not least, is Skylar Speakman, Senior Research Scientist. Skylar, watching the conference, what was your favorite?
Yeah, a non-technical take on this is just how much fun they were having during the keynote. Arvind marched a mascot penguin across the stage, and the crowd loved it. So it was really cool to see people having fun up on stage during those keynotes.
Penguins, agents, and programming, all that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together the smartest, most talented, most wonderful experts in all of artificial intelligence to talk a little bit about the biggest news in the sector. And this is a big episode. We've got a lot that we need to talk about as per usual, a really fascinating story coming out of the New York Times about AI and hallucination, a bunch of news coming out of OpenAI in terms of its corporate organization and its recent acquisition of Windsurf. But first, I want to start with IBM Think, which was the big IBM conference of the year. Tons and tons of announcements and things to go through. But I think the one that was most important to me, of course, was that I do want to start with is, Kate, I realize you have a book coming out that was also kind of announced at IBM Think. So maybe I'll just start there for the plug.
Yeah, no, thanks, Tim. So we did release a book. I've got it here with me. It's called AI Value Creators. Really excited to be able to share it more broadly. A lot of what we talked about at Think, particularly in some of the future-looking sessions, like on generative computing, we actually have whole chapters dedicated to in the book. It's really all about how can, you know, folks looking to not just build with generative AI, but kind of build a competitive moat with generative AI, get the most value and invest in strategic places. So really, really excited for folks to check it out. We actually have a download link for all of our Mixture of Expert listeners. So we'll include that in the show notes and would love any feedback the team has as they read through the content.
That's great. And Kate, I guess for those who are kind of just getting their head around generative computing, what's the general concept there? Do you want to give us like a little bit of a flavor of how, you know, it sounds like it's a big part of the keynote, it's a big part of the book, just kind of interested in how all these pieces are fitting together and what is generative computing?
Yeah, so I think at the end of the day, it's really just trying to bring some of generative AI back to the realm of computer science. You know, if you look at how we've emerged building applications and agents with LLMs today, it's all basically a form of prompt engineering, where we end up with these really massive, you know, pages and pages of prompts. We call them essay prompts in our book, where it can be very difficult to maintain. These prompts are very brittle. You look at how they're written, they're kind of like over-optimize and force fit for a specific model. And it's just not very sustainable, secure. There's all sorts of issues. And if we think about how we build in a more computer science forward discipline, you know, there needs to be abstractions for key activities that we want a model to take on. And there needs to be ways to set, you know, clear control flow of how we build programs versus, you know, instead of asking a model, first do this, then do this, then do this, you know, we can actually build a lot of the same code. We don't need to ask a model to do everything. So it's really about how can we take some of these best practices from software engineering and computer science and bring in all the power that models have to be able to express natural language and run functions in natural language and bring them together in a much more maintainable way.
Nice. Yeah, that really is, I think, the future is just like now moving into like, how do we make this production, you know, at scale? So it's very exciting to
see. Absolutely. And I think there's a lot also that goes on when you start to build things in a little bit more structure, where you can take advantage of a lot of techniques that are coming out in the field around inference scaling and inference time compute. So instead of running one big massive prompt once, how do you break it up into smaller parts, run multiple generations, and use that to create an even richer response, often in far less time, far less compute. And so all of that and more, we really get into in the book.
That's great. Yeah, well, I encourage everybody to check it out. I think the next one I want to touch on is, Kautar, you have already won the MOE award for mentioning agent first in the episode. But it is genuinely exciting. I mean, in some ways, it's no surprise that IBM would be announcing a kind of like product leap in agents. But do you want to talk a little bit about what's happening and why you find it exciting?
Yes, definitely. So IBM, you know, I think introduced, you know, over 150 pre-built AI agents through the Watson X Orchestrate platform. And I thought that's really huge, you know, enabling, you know, basically enterprises to deploy AI-driven workloads rapidly. So these agents, they're designed to be kind of pre-built. You can integrate them seamlessly with popular enterprise tools like Salesforce and Workday and Adobe, and allows, you know, businesses to automate tasks and enhance also productivity. So, and, you know, this is, you know, kind of showcasing our approach, IBM's approach to support the creation of custom AI agents, I think, which is also very important, relying first on the Granite models, as well as models from Meta and Mistral. So it's also a modular approach that provides you flexibility, that also facilitates, you know, tailoring, you know, your solutions for diverse business needs. I think that that was also very, very important. Basically, you know, this flexibility that provides is not just about, you know, one approach, but, you know, you can integrate different models, you know, in a, you know, flexible and modular way, and allows you also to customize in addition to pre-built the existing AI agents that you can just add and customize.
Yeah, for sure. And I did want to touch on that. I mean, Skylar, before we talk about the mascot, which I do want to hear more about, but I guess, Kay, the mention of Granite, I guess you've been name-checked, so I do got to kind of bring it back to you. I understand there is an announcement coming out about Granite, actually, from IBM Think.
So on Friday, actually, so we did a sneak preview. We didn't tell anyone we were going to do this. We released a preview of our Granite 4 models, and we got to talk about them a lot at Think. So that was also a really exciting part of the conference. These models, we can post a link to the blog that talks about the new architecture behind them. But basically, they're a mixture of experts hybrid model. So they are very fast, very efficient. The tiny preview that we just released only takes 15 gigs of memory. So even running, you know, 128K context length with multiple concurrencies. So we think these models are going to be really efficient and excellent counterpoints to complement much larger models that are being deployed. You know, having those bigger models and then the smaller efficient Granite models working together hand in hand.
I really like the emphasis here on smaller, domain specific, and also the energy efficiency. Because, you know, if you see these models, they, you know, the sizes, they range from 3 to 20 billion parameters, as opposed to what you see like, you know, trillion parameters or many billion parameters in the open source or in other models. So it's you know, the key thing here is, you know, how do you build these things that are optimized for specific industries and offering cost-effective and efficient alternative to the larger general purpose model? So I really like, you know, the focus on the efficiency here.
Yeah, for sure. So Skylar, curious if you want to tell us more about the mascot, but I think in general, like I thought what was very striking about your response was you're like, it's so much fun, which I think is actually like an important part of all this.
Exactly.
But yeah, we'd love to kind of hear what you saw. Yeah.
I know. I think that just sort of captures it. They had kind of this transition from having these Ferrari race car team members up on stage talking about how they're using IBM tech. And then there was this pivot to IBM's relationship with Red Hat and, of course, Linux more broadly. And a penguin mascot just starts walking across the back of the stage. Great. So hats off to whoever had that planned. Maybe it was last minute. Maybe that's been someone's dream for a year. I don't know. But I thought it was well done.
Yeah, for sure. And I do like this. Like one of the things I'm really fascinated by is like how all the companies that are kind of in the AI space are kind of coming up with their own brands about how they present AI stuff, right? Like some companies are very serious and some companies are very technical, in kind of like a very granular, kind of like almost academic way. And it's kind of fun seeing IBM kind of take like a certain level of fun in terms of like how to present and talk about this stuff. So that's very cool. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Super interesting article that kind of hit the New York Times, I believe this week or last week, focusing on sort of the kind of rise of hallucinations with the emergence of reasoning models. And we haven't talked about hallucinations on the show for a little while, but obviously it kind of remains a sort of big question, a big problem that people are sort of working on in the space. And I guess maybe, Skyla, maybe I'll stay with you, is do you have an intuition for why it seems? So the article seemed to argue that like reasoning models are like newly hallucinatory in a way that we are learning to deal with. And is that the case? And do you have an intuition for why?
Hallucinations themselves are not new. It does appear that they are on the rise. There was this great contraposition of, they had asked a spokesperson for comment. They said, no, they're not on the rise. But if you go and check the receipts and look at the model cards that OpenAI also produces, you do see 04 Mini hallucinating more than 03 and 03 hallucinating more than 01.
It's like definitely on the rise.
Yes, it is. Yeah. But they're also very clear to say they don't know why. And I'm also going to draw a blank. Sorry, I'm not quite sure. I don't have any really gut instincts as to why those are increasing. Accuracy is going up. They're getting better at math, but hallucinations are also increasing. So it is something that really does need a lot more attention paid to it.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the really interesting things is like, I feel like the AI era is teaching us all the ways in which intelligence is very lumpy. You know, like the model gets really good at one thing, but and you kind of expect that it'll be good at everything else in a well-rounded way. But like that kind of doesn't seem to be the case. Kate, like I'm curious if you've got intuitions or similar like Skylar, you're like, I don't know, it's just weird.
Yeah, I mean, I will give my thoughts. Obviously, I think there's a lot that's still left to be discovered. But to me, it seems like it's a kind of classic example of just misaligned incentives. So we've got, you know, these models are going through extensive reinforcement learning pipelines in order to improve the model's verbosity, among other things, to get it to say more and to try and craft these well-rounded responses that humans will prefer. And, you know, there is some degree of, you know, any human likes to hear people who are persuasive speakers talk. We're not very good at fact-checking things. And we don't naturally resonate with something that is just black and white, the answer is X. We want to know why. We want to hear more and more thought. And we question things less when we hear that thought process. And that's a little bit counter to a different objective function that was originally solved for, which is much more get the answer exactly correct. And that's how pre-reasoning models were, that was certainly the focus. And so I expect there's just some, you know, misalignment in those objective functions, and we're trying to solve for a lot of different things. And we're waiting, having these really verbose thought processes that are much harder to check for factual accuracy when that training data is created. And that, you know, just innately are going to promote having more chances to hallucinate in any given response than, you know, the answer is X.
Katar, are you optimistic in the end with all this? I remember a few years ago, I was talking to a researcher who was like, don't worry, in like 18 months, there will just be no more hallucinations. We're going to just crack the problem. It's solved, right? Like, there's going to be less and less hallucinations, and it's just going to be done. And I guess kind of what's interesting about this article is almost the idea that like hallucinations might be kind of like a thing that keeps coming back as the technology advances. And I guess from where you're sitting, I mean, do you feel like, yeah, maybe in 2030, you know, we won't even be talking about hallucination anymore because it's kind of a solved problem? Or is this really something persistent that we're going to be dealing with for a long time?
Yeah, I think it's going to be persists. Maybe we'll have, you know, different techniques or methods or maybe hybrid approaches where we need to do also factual checking. So what's happening here is these models, they use probabilistic, not logic, you know, probabilities, you know, and not logic to predict these responses. And reinforcement learning helps in math and coding, but also causes the model, like Kate mentioned, to forget, you know, some of these functional consistencies, you know, the reasoning models, they take these multi-step approaches to the problem solving. And each step introduces also this compound effect of hallucination. So the tools today, they can't keep up. So of course, a lot of work in research to build tools to trace, you know, the AI output back to the training data. But these systems are very, you know, complex, really too large to fully understand. And the explanations even that are shown to the user, sometimes they really don't reflect the model's actual internal process. So what are really the broad implications here? So accuracy is kind of eroding here. Even as the LLMs become more powerful in cognitive tasks, their grip on the factual reliability, you know, is loosening here. And of course, this has a lot of enterprise concerns. And so I think the challenge still remains unresolved. You know, this despite many efforts from OpenAI, Google, DeepSeek, and others, there is no clear fix. So hallucination appears to be, you know, kind of an intrinsic limitations of the current model architectures. So what I'm thinking is we need kind of hybrid approaches, not just relying on the model, but see if we can, you know, combine that with other systems to do these reasoning, kind of symbolic reasoning, combine them with symbolic reasoning systems or factual check-ins. So hopefully that can kind of resolve these issues that we find.
Yeah, and I did want to get into that as like, I mean, you, Kautar, I think you point out quite rightly, like from an enterprise standpoint, I'm a company that's about to implement this stuff. I'm reading in the New York Times that like these great new models that people are trying to pitch me on, like I hallucinate more. I mean, Skylar, what's to be done, right? I think Kautar is kind of throwing out like maybe we need more symbolic approaches. Like what is the kind of toolkit of things that we do to try to kind of deal with this, particularly in a setting where, you know, business is trying to implement this, they need the reliability.
I think that point right there at the end is very important. Which use case are these being built for? Hallucinations during your Google search? It's annoying, but it's not game breaking. Using a tool in order to improve some sort of legal argument or medical diagnosis, incredibly important. So I think these hallucinations will always be with us. I did think it would be on a downward trend. Tim, as you had said earlier, I am surprised they're going up because there are teams of researchers working on this problem. And they seem to be falling behind the pace, the progress of the LLMs is if we're just kind of, you know, reading the hallucination rates as they increase. So I think what's probably the most key important part here is what's your downstream use case and are hallucinations game breaking in those? Then there will be some serious pause about how you really roll out AI into your workflows. If you're using it to speed up a internet query, I think we're going to have some entertaining hallucinations for another 5 years to come yet.
Well, and if I can make a plug for generative computing, like I think this is exactly the type of thing we're trying to solve and to wrap our heads around for real deployed use cases. How do we set up workflows so that it's not just a model giving carte blanche to go and create tons of chain of thought, do a bunch of actions, hallucinate some things, give a response back? But instead, how can you have very programmatic control steps with checks where you're validating the outputs programmatically and where you really reduce the scope of what the model does at any one point in time so that you can really try and reduce your risks of hallucination and other safety issues? And a key part to that is also bringing in additional layers of security. So for example, we've got our Granite Guardian models, which can detect hallucinations in any grounded response or function call. So there's all sorts of tools that you can start to layer in if you're not taking what I call like the YOLO prompt approach, where you just create one big prompt, throw it at the model and, you know, fingers crossed, hope for the best. But if you start to break this out, it takes a little bit more work to set up, but it gives you so much more control over the risks and the performance at any given part in the process that I think it will be, you know, really critical for real life enterprise deployments.
Yeah, I think this is still like one of the kind of funniest ironies, I think, of the AI era is, you know, you've built a thing that's like, it's in the computer, but it doesn't really behave like computing. And like, there's all this work now to kind of like put it back in the box and make it behave like a more traditional computer, because you need it for all sorts of like very practical, you know, reliability reasons, security reasons, safety reasons.
Like there are prompts out there where it says in all caps, do not hallucinate. Like, that's not computer science. Like, this is, we've lost all, you know, grounding to reality here. That's not how computer science is done. So we need to get to a better way of working.
Yeah, it is the fact that we're seeing right now, the smarter these models are getting at reasoning, the less we can trust them on facts. So fixing hallucinations, you know, they may require more than just reinforcement learning as it is being used today. So like Kate mentioned, we really need new architectures and new programming paradigm that really explicitly encode truth constraints, you know, on or modular hybrid systems like that combine LLMs with verifiable databases or symbolic logic engines, you know, and that's, you know, I think at the core of what generative computing is trying to do.
I want to move us to the last story of today. It was announced, or rather it was leaked ultimately, that OpenAI is about to make an acquisition of Windsurf, which is effectively kind of a coding environment. And it would be, the number that has been leaked is that the acquisition would be $3 billion, right? Which would make it the biggest OpenAI acquisition to date. And obviously just like a gigantic acquisition in its own right. And, you know, I guess maybe Kate, to go back to you, like some people were saying online that this is kind of like, in some ways, like evidence that a lot of this AGI stuff is marketing, right? Because if you really believe that AGI was about to come about, why would you spend $3 billion on, you know, essentially like a text editor with like some AI components added to it? And so, yeah, kind of curious about like how you size that up. Like, do you buy that argument, which is like, yeah, it kind of seems like maybe OpenAI is speaking out two sides of its mouth here.
So I think OpenAI probably is speaking out of many different sides of its mouth at all times. But I do think that it makes a lot of sense. And I don't think it's mutually exclusive. So if you look at how OpenAI became the behemoth that it is today, they released a chat interface. They found a UI that all of a sudden made their models relevant to the mass consumers. And then they had millions of people all of a sudden using that interface, generating data that they used to bootstrap their way, like rocket ship their way into really high performant models. And I think what we're seeing is the killer use case of 2025 and probably for a while is coding assistants. And they don't have their own UI, their own access to developers in that arena. So they're losing that advantage that gave them this amazing starting point in position. And so I see it very much as their, you know, and it makes total sense they would spend this type of money on it, their way to try and regain some of that advantage and to better understand how their users are using the models and, you know, figuring out how to continue to improve the models moving forward.
Skylar, this is like a little bit of a weird outcome though, right? Because I could have remembered when like ChatGPT first came out and like everybody was doing kind of like startups around AI. People were like, oh, well, you're just like a thin wrapper around GPT. Or like, you know, that's not a real company. That's just a wrapper around GPT. But like $3 billion, like it does really feel like these wrappers are quite valuable now, right? And it's kind of almost like an inversion from what we thought, you know, earlier in the game. Is that the right interpretation?
I think while we're talking about doublespeak or talking about both sides of your mouth, I think on one hand, you can call it a wrapper. I think on another hand, you can view Windsurf or some of these other companies as integrators. And OpenAI, great at model building, but they haven't, as Kate's pointed out, they haven't really integrated into other spaces. They had a great chatbot interface. And I think while these models are continuing to grow, integration is the complementary scarce factor that's lagging behind. And so yes, wrapper or integrator, depending on which way you really view it. I do think OpenAI knows where it sits in terms of the model building game. And they probably saw a bit of a weakness in their own structure of how do we actually deploy this on people's machines that's not a chat interface. And so again, maybe thinking of this more as integrating systems into the language models rather than a wrapper is probably why you end up with a $3 billion as opposed to the just a wrapper, I take. How it plays out, we don't know. But I do think there's this interesting take on the difference between building models and then actually integrating those into workflows. And this might be OpenAI covering its bases on the latter.
Yeah, I love the idea that's kind of like a valuable wrapper is an integrator. Yeah, it's like, yes. once you get valuable enough, like that's what you've transformed into. Katzer, where does this all go, right? Because it kind of suggests like this sort of vertical integration in the space where, you know, coding assistants have obviously is like a really big use case, as Kate mentioned. And so it kind of makes sense that the model provider would eventually kind of like get one of those, right? And it would be vertically integrated. Like, I'm kind of thinking about, like, are there other domains you think that an OpenAI might be interested? Because I think what's interesting about AI, right, is, of course, that it can be applied across all these different domains. And so it's kind of like, well, maybe it's not going to be a $3 billion acquisition, but, like, where else could they be going, I guess, that they might want to kind of create this sort of, like, you know, they both control the model layer and then also the application layer.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think the example that Windsurf showed us here is they build this sticky developer workflow and additional trust layer over GPT, like, you know, what we all were referring to as the wrapper. And here, OpenAI's reaction, it's just not, they don't want just to own the model, but also the developer experience and the ecosystem. So it seems like we're entering here a phase where these verticalized co-pilots for example, for finance, for law, for science, for medical, et cetera, they're the new battleground. And owning the UX layer is a very strategic approach here. And I think that's what's, you know, it's a smart play that OpenAI is doing, because as the model layer commoditizes here, the moat is the ecosystem and the developer tooling. And especially as we're moving in more of these agentic AI, this vertical integration becomes very important if you really want to have a strategic advantage and be competitive in the marketplace.
Yeah, and I think it kind of leads to a world where it kind of feels like maybe OpenAI is going to become like, they're going to almost like take the Apple model, right? Where like everything's vertically integrated. You know, they build the hardware, they have like, you know, apps that are like definitely their apps, and it's just kind of end to end. I mean, Kate, do you think that's going to be the sort of future of AI where you almost have like kind of like some companies that are like Apple, other companies that are just like kind of, you know, it's like a ThinkPad, right? It's like a piece of a computer that you can run anything on.
No, I definitely agree. And building on Kautar, I really like how you framed it as, you know, we're starting to see commoditization at the model layer. And I think for a lot of, you know, tasks like coding assistance, we are absolutely hitting a point where many models are going to start to converge on very similar layers of performance. And so then how do you differentiate? You make really high switching costs. Or how do you develop your competitive moat, rather? You make really high switching costs so that it's, once you're kind of in the ecosystem, you're not going to switch over to whoever's, you know, offering the same offering for a few cents cheaper. And from that perspective, I think OpenAI and I think other providers are going to continue to invest in that. And that's why it's really important we continue to support a robust open source ecosystem in order to make sure that we have kind of diversity of technology, of thought, and ultimately are optimizing the efficiency of generative AI and trying to continue to bring down costs and push advantages and make sure that we don't just get kind of locked into these single provider ecosystems.
Yeah, for sure. Skylar, any thoughts on this?
An analogy I've heard once before was, I don't know, you go back 30 years and people defined their compute experience by what OS they used, you know, were you Windows or your Mac? And then that's converged. And then it was what browser you used that identified your user experience. And those have converged. Right now we're in the space where people, you know, swear by one particular LLM. And I do think that will eventually converge as well. There will be small nuances here and there, but at least from a consumer perspective, I do see them as converging. We've seen it before happening over technology where that sort of decision defined your compute experience. And then fast forward 5 years and you can see that actually a lot of the options are pretty similar. I can see that sort of progression happening here with your chatbot of choice.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think a little bit about, if you remember that old commercial, like, oh, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC.
Yep.
It's like, I'm waiting for that commercial that'll yes. be like, I'm an open AI coding assistant, you yep. know, like I'm an open source coding assistant. Well, more to come soon. As always, action packed, a lot to cover, way more to cover than we have time for. But as always, thanks for joining us. Skylar, great to see you again. Kautar, Kate, always great to have you on the show. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.